You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
Boris Johnson and I, with the United Nations Special Envoy, Ismail al-Sheikh Ahmed, are calling today for the implementation of a ceasefire.
Britain and the US call for a ceasefire in Yemen within hours. We'll assess the situation as war continues for much longer than anyone had predicted. Also ahead,
well, here's an update on our breaking news story here in RT International. All of our channel's bank accounts have been blocked in the UK without any explanation.
Russia's state broadcaster reaches for the piggy bank as its UK bank accounts are frozen. Plus, hate crime is on the rise in post-Brexit Britain, and it seems in Canada too. And a little later,
now, I'm not adding any salt, and you'll very rarely find any salt in any pasta recipes, because in fact, when you season the water to cook your pasta, that's when you're actually seasoned.
I hope you're hungry. We're going to consider what might be on Chef Mario Batali's menu for President Obama's final state dinner. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are William Patey, International Affairs Advisor at Control Risks and former British Ambassador to Sudan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, and Raphael Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. First today to Iraq, where about 4,000 Kurdish Peshmerga troops are involved in an operation to retake 10 villages from the Islamic State group. It's the first part of the battle to liberate Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, which has been occupied by IS militants for more than 2 years. The start of this offensive was announced by the Iraqi Prime Minister earlier this morning. And we'll start with you, William. So how swift do you think it could be that we see this city fall?
Well, I don't think it'll be swift, and to a great extent it'll depend on whether Daesh or IS stand and fight, and we don't know yet. They've tactically withdrawn in the past, but it may be that Mosul is such an important place that they'll fight to the end. And if they do, then it'll take a long time. I mean, there are estimates of anything between 2,000 to 8,000 IS fighters in the city. If it's the higher number, even if it's the smaller number, they're well dug in. They've had plenty of warning that this was coming. They've got tunnels. Urban warfare, as we know, in Ramadi and Fallujah can be very, very bitter, prolonged and dangerous.
But just because of the amount of, you know, pre-warnings that there were, is there a sense that actually it may be an easier fight because they may have decided to leave the battleground before the battle comes to them?
Well, that would be the hope, that they consolidate, they expect. But, you know, maybe Raphael was get himself into the mind of IS and Daesh. I've never been able to fathom the sort of person who is Daesh. But it could go one of two ways. They could fight to the bitter end, in which case it will be long and prolonged, or they could make a tactical retreat. I don't think we know at this stage which of these they will unfold.
Raphael, let's take it for given that the city will fall in the coming days, weeks, months. What does that mean for Islamic State, especially in the Iraqi field?
Well, I mean, I think tactically they'll go back to the mountains, you know, and return to some sort of insurgency terrorist organization, which has a sort of lighter footprint in Iraq. I think we also have to remember that they will continue to exist on the battlefield in Syria. You know, yes, Dabiq has fallen. Yes, they've lost some other bases, but Raqqa is still a sort of IS stronghold. For how much longer is a good question. But, the battlefield in Syria will remain very fluid and will give them probably a space that they can operate into. So I suspect you're going to see them sort of moving off and evolving into something different. I think in some ways, the question is, what does this mean for them as an attractive organization that people want to be with and fight alongside? Because I think they drew a lot of their power from the fact that they had, you know, built this sort of state, this proto-state thing with these two huge cities in Iraq and Syria that sort of spanned a territory that, you know, by some estimates was the size of England, you know, and that they controlled this sort of land. And this was what gave their thing a lot of their sort of vision and ideology, a lot of its strength. And so in its absence, you wonder how much will that narrative lose some of its appeal and it become somewhat weakened.
And it's certainly the videos that we saw, Rafael, that used to come out showing them running, you know, I don't know, all sorts of things like hospitals and, you know, GP services, those things must be long gone. And do you think this knocks out the attractiveness for a kind of a young generation of radicalized youth who felt that they were going to move to, literally an Islamic state?
Well, I mean, I think, actually, oddly enough, I was looking for this today and I saw that they were still posting a short video of a water bottling plant that they apparently have in Raqqa. So they are still projecting out some of these things. So it hasn't completely gone away. And then the other point to make is, well, we've seen numbers of foreign fighters going has really precipitously fallen off. You know, I think it was about 10% of what it used to be. I think it was this time last year. It's about 10% of it now. There is still that 10% who are going. So it hasn't completely gone away. So I think we have to be very careful to say that, you know, this victory in Mosul, when Mosul is eventually taken, this is the end of the organization. I think it's an organization that's been around in some shape or form since the late 1990s, and it's shown remarkable resilience to sort of grow and shrink. And I think what we're going to see now is it's going to shrink back. And the question is, what's it shrink back into, and how much are sort of the Iraqi government in particular and Western powers able to focus on what is still left of it to continue to try to drive it down, rather than it sort of slipping away and evolving into something else and maybe popping up again later as a problem somewhere else?
I mean, I would say in sort of Chilean terms, it's the beginning of the end of, in its current form. And I think Rafael's right that part of its differentiation from Al-Qaeda was it held territory, it had declared a caliphate. Al-Qaeda very deliberately didn't try to hold territory. So if it loses territory, it loses Mosul and eventually loses Raqqa, it will not be as differentiated from other extremist jihadi terrorist groups in the way it currently is.
William, you know, you've worked in Iraq. What do you think this means for, you know, what we all hope for, you know, a peaceful, secure Iraq? Is this a building block towards that end?
Well, it offers an opportunity, but it's a huge challenge. I mean, I don't think any of Iraq's current political problems will go away. And if any, they will accentuate. Up to now, they've kind of had a free reign because everyone's been united against Daesh, against ISIS. When the government retakes Mosul, they've still got to address the political exclusion of the Sunnis and the fact that the Sunnis don't feel part of the new Iraq. They don't feel they're listened to. They don't feel they've got a stake. So some of the political problems that currently beset Iraq are not going to go away. Indeed, they could get worse. And I think unless there is some change in the politics in Baghdad amongst mainly Shia politicians to make a decent offer to the Sunnis, we'll very quickly have ISIS 3.0, or as people like to say, or Al-Qaeda 3.0, because you'll have a disillusioned Sunni population that was, some of whom were sympathetic to Daesh in the first place.
Rafael, you talked about the escape route, in a way, as it were, to Syria and, you know, this other kind of territory where IS is very strong. In a way, is the only way to put the stopper in the bottle is actually for Raqqa to fall, is for the other kind of places where they have, you know, their troops and their fighters to fall as well.
Well, yes. I mean, clearly, you know, it's always going to be a two-pronged battle. On the one hand, you do have to get rid of the organization and destroy its physical infrastructure and make sure that it doesn't sort of exist as an entity which controls territory and can do all these sorts of things. But on the other side of the equation, you have to do exactly what William was talking about, which is make sure that you then eliminate the conditions which make the sort of environment conducive for the organization to succeed and thrive. And that's going to be essential to do in Iraq, to make sure that the Iraqi governance system is able to make Sunnis feel like they have a stake in the society. I think what's really difficult is how do you do that in Syria, where you're still dealing with a context that is a live civil war, that even if you get rid of ISIS or destroy its sort of infrastructure, there's still going to be an ongoing battle between the Assad regime, between the Kurds, between the various other factions that are fighting on the ground, and between, you know, Al-Qaeda's representatives on the ground. So that battle will continue, and into that space, it's very difficult to see how you're going to completely eradicate an environment that provides some sort of a backdrop for ISIS to potentially set seed.
Well, we should bring a kind of connected story here, which is Yemen, where a ceasefire could come into effect within hours if calls by Boris Johnson and John Kerry are heeded. The US Secretary of State met with the UK's Foreign Secretary here in London following the deaths of 140 people in a Saudi airstrike. Fighting between Iranian-backed Houthis and the Yemeni government, which is supported by the Gulf states, has been raging now for more than 18 months. William, again, when we look at what's happening here, another kind of cauldron where it's very difficult to see how you get to a very, you know, back to a peaceful situation. Do you think it's right that we could see a ceasefire? And how would that ceasefire, you know, turn into a meaningful arrangement?
Well, I don't think we're hours away from a ceasefire just because John Kerry and Boris Johnson called for it. I think that's a function of their disquiet at the level of civilian casualties that have we've seen in recent months, and particularly the bombing of a funeral in Yemen, which the Saudis themselves have said was a mistake and are investigating. So there's a degree of urgency about the need for a ceasefire because the war itself is producing strains within the Western alliance with Saudi Arabia. I think Saudi Arabia would like a ceasefire. Mm. I think part of the problem is that convincing the Houthis and the former regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh to come to the table and offer something meaningful is a problem. And that's what the Saudis have been trying to do through military pressure, force them to the negotiating table. But talks that were convened in Kuwait failed. It's hard to see what would bring the Houthis and Abdullah al-Saleh to the table other than defeat or greater losses on the battlefield.
Rafael, is there a kind of interesting moral conundrum here? Because I wonder why this is one of the reasons they've called for this ceasefire. At one point, they're saying to the Russians, "Stop bombing in Aleppo. You know, you're bombing people you think are terrorists. We're not so convinced. We don't want you to do that." It would be almost impossible for them then to say to Saudi Arabia, "Oh, you know, carry on with your bombing. You know, we've just seen 140 people killed." Do you think that they've been kind of forced into this kind of like, it's time for these ceasefires to be coming to action everywhere because they couldn't really begin to differentiate between the two anymore?
Well, I mean, certainly that's a narrative you hear in the Middle East where they say, you know, you care about one, but you don't care about the other. And this is sort of these atrocities that are being set up by the Saudis. And why didn't you accuse the Saudis because they're your big ally and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think that that's certainly a narrative that exists. Whether it's completely true, I don't know. I think there has been some question about the degree to which the West has kind of let the Saudis get on with something, this is not the first, you know, terrible thing to happen on that battlefield, quite frankly. And why is it this particular one is attracting so much attention? I would argue that it's probably accumulation of things. And it's just this particular incident has really shone a light on something that people have been sort of wondering about for some time. I don't know if there's a direct link to be made with what the Russians have been doing. And, you know, if you're calling one, you should certainly be calling the other. I think the Russians have also been doing this sort of indiscriminate bombing for some time, and it's not exactly sort of new. And I think there's been a lot of accusations there that have been leveled against the Assad regime with its barrel bombs previously. So I think there has been a lot of accusations going in both directions for some time. I think this particular atrocity, you know, 140 people getting killed is a particularly large number, which I think really shines a light on it.
Both sides have to abide by international humanitarian law, but there's a big difference between the Russians propping up their ally for strategic reasons, resisting a popular revolution against them, and the Saudis, who intervened on behalf of a government that emerged after the Arab Spring and after they had got rid of Ali Abdullah Saleh, a dictatorship. So there isn't really a sort of moral equivalence, I don't think. And I think we've got to, these issues are not black and white. I think we have to insist on the laws of war being followed. They're certainly not being followed by the Russians. The Saudis at least are trying to follow them, even if they're making mistakes. So I think there's a little bit of a difference.
Well, and just to question that difference, you know, we know that one of the reasons the Saudis have intervened is because they fear Iranian influence, you know, around the Gulf, and the Iranians are backing the Houthis. So in a way, they are trying to, you know, stop an enemy and prop up a government that they feel can deter Iranian influence, aren't they?
Oh, but without doubt, the Saudis have clear strategic interests here. They feel themselves surrounded by Iran, which has undue influence in Iraq, Iran with undue influence in Syria and in Lebanon, and now in Yemen, with which Saudi Arabia shares a 1,000-kilometer-plus border. Mm. The idea of Iranians being having influence in the south of the Arabian Peninsula peninsula is completely anathema to the Saudis. And that's why they've intervened. The Saudis don't have a history of intervening very often. So when they do, you can...
They try to get others to do it for them.
Yeah, absolutely. But when they intervene directly, you can be sure they think there's a vital national interest at stake.
Well, intriguing events. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Raffaello Pantucci and William Patey. Coming up next, Russia's state broadcaster finds its UK bank accounts frozen. And what might be on the menu for President Obama's final state dinner? Stay tuned.
Monocle is heading for the Frankfurt Book Fair. From Wednesday until Sunday, we're back at the premier event for publishers and booksellers with our signature shop, coffee bar and live Monocle 24 radio setup. So whether it's a pit stop for a crisp Forscht beer, the smoothest flat white in the Messe, or simply some relaxing retail therapy, we have the bases covered and can't wait to welcome you. With the latest stellar addition to our fast-growing catalogue of books, The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, hot off the presses, there's an extra reason to stop by our stand, meet the team, and collect your copy. Monocle at the Frankfurt Book Fair, from Wednesday until Sunday. See you there.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Still with me are William Patey and Raffaello Pantucci. Now, viewers tuning into Russian state television network RT were treated to some breaking news earlier today. The broadcaster's UK bank accounts were frozen, apparently without expectation, explanation even. In reality, it seems the network had actually been warned that its British bank, NatWest, would no longer be providing financial services. RT's editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonian, said that they have failed to defeat us by simply vilifying us, but picking on our broadcast. So they've instead, they have decided instead to try the banking flank. Apologies for mumbling that a little bit. Though, given RT's flirtations with the fanciful, one might suspect that RT weren't entirely surprised by NatWest's decision. Now, they're trumpeting this as the British government taking action. Well, William, we'll start with you. Do you think it's the bank or the government?
It's the bank. I'm absolutely confident that the British government would not seek to influence RT by this way. They've already intervened where they are able to intervene through the Ofcom, and RT has fallen foul of the broadcasting standards and been upbraided by the British government. I'm pretty confident that this is NatWest going through their own de-risking process. Every bank, international bank, is having to worry about sanctions, beneficial owners, the sorts of clients they have. And I imagine the people, the head of risk at NatWest has had a look at RT and said, don't fancy this. We'll just decline this account.
So do you imagine they wonder whether up the chain there's somebody connected to this whose sanctions are connected to, that they may be breaching those sanctions? Or
well, there'll be some concern when the bank's gone through its know your customer, its due diligence, which they have to do. They may have come up against some ownership issues, maybe some sanctioned individuals. Who knows? I don't know. And the bank are under no obligation to tell us, and they're under no obligation to tell RT either. But that would be my assessment of it, rather than any interference by the British government.
Do you think they'll just find another friendly bank that will take them on?
Well, I think they'll have to go look for one. I mean, how they'll be able to find one, I don't know. But I mean, I think William's entirely right. The bank probably just went through their process and concluded that this is just a bit too shady. And I think you have to remember some of the fines that banks have been hit with as a result of some of these dodgy accounts or, you know, shady people they've worked with in the past. And I think you've seen the size of some of these fines that are coming out of the US in particular, so large, the banks are reacting by very much taking a much more forward posture. And so any potential risk now becomes a risk that you're not going to accept and you sort of get off the books. And, you know, do you really need to have the bank accounts of a TV channel in the United Kingdom? Is that really going to change your overall balance sheet? I suspect not. It's a fairly low number, and just get rid of it and then you can sort of move on with your life. The downside is, what if it turns out that one of the individuals linked to the bank is a sanctioned person or is linked to some sanctioned entity in Russia? And what might the Department of Justice do to punish you? You know, we're talking potentially billions of pounds or dollars of fines, which the bank certainly wants to avoid. And so I think that the approach, and you've seen this, I think, in a number of cases recently, there was a whole raft of Islamist charities in the UK that had a similar problem. I think it was late last year, earlier this year. And they all suddenly got letters from their bank telling them, you know, you can't, you know, we're no longer banking you. I'm sorry, goodbye. Not given any explanation. They all got very angry, saying it was the government. Again, I think it was the bank probably just going back through and saying, well, you know, in light of some of the fines we've seen, we're just going to walk away from these ones. Thank you.
And RT's joining a list of foreign embassies. I remember a number of foreign ambassadors sort of coming to me say that their accounts have been closed. It's the same thing, but, you know, the diplomatic embassies had trouble getting accounts open. So I think RT's been quite late in the day in coming to this party.
Yeah.
Just before we move on, I think we can agree that the government probably wasn't behind it. But, you know, in the sense of wanting it shut down, how much of a thorn in the side of the British government do you think RT is? Because it's amusing when you watch it, because it's such a different, from every point of view you have, they go and take the opposite point of view. But it seems to be, you know,
Jeremy Corbyn was a regular on it, right? And he's the leader of the opposition, so.
Well, I've appeared on it. I haven't appeared on it recently. They don't like my combative style when they come up. It's the only TV and radio programme I've been on where they use words like British imperialism.
Right.
And I think that's really quite a challenge to be asked about British imperialism and the 21st century.
Well, I hope there's not meant to be a check in the post for you. allegations of hate crime here in Britain have surged about 41% since the UK voted to leave the European Union. It's a frightening statistic that ought to concern everyone, but sadly, it's part of a rising tide not limited to Britain. The number of radical far-right groups increased 14% between 2014 and 2015. And it's believed that there are at least 100 far-right extremist groups that have been active in Canada within recent years, a stark contrast to the nation's image as an open society that's taken in more than 30,000 Syrian refugees alone. Raffaella, does that surprise you about the Canada narrative? Because we do think of Canada as being somewhere that's incredibly tolerant, and it's been a very open society. It's a nation built on migration.
Mm.
But why are we seeing even here hate crimes on the rise?
I mean, I think, you know, I must say on Canada, I'm not entirely surprised, partially because we've been doing some work at my institute looking at the Canadian sort of context. So I had sort of observed this before this particular story. And in some ways, it's not surprising. It does fit into a broader trend that you can see in the United Kingdom, that you can see in Europe more generally, of a sort of resurgent right wing and an extreme right wing. And not only a sort of, you know, not only sort of terrorist cells, but also the political center seems to have shifted a bit to the right. And sort of narratives that previously would have been considered, you know, outside the sort of acceptable political discourse are increasingly slipping into it. Whenever that starts to happen, you'll see the extreme edge coming as well. And I think that's very much part of a polarization that you've seen of the political debates in the West in general. You know, the one tweak I'll add to that, however, on this question of the specific race and religious hate crimes reporting that we've seen, in particular in the UK, and this sort of spike in numbers that we've seen. Actually, there is a bit of an increase in numbers, but it's always very difficult to focus on these numbers because there is often, when you look at this, there's an awful lot of bias in some of the reporting. When people hear that there's a lot of this happening, they do tend to report a lot more. So it's always a bit unclear how much we can link it to a specific event like Brexit, or how much actually this is a broader trend that was going on and has been going on in the UK and Europe for some time.
William, do you think we are seeing a genuine, you know, uptick in the number of hate crimes?
Well, whether it's more reporting or actual increase, I don't know. But we're certainly hearing more about it. And it's perhaps not surprising when you consider the tone of the debate in the United States and in Britain, the debate over Brexit. I mean, there's a lot of people who complain about political correctness, but political correctness is just civilized behavior.
Exactly.
And sometimes when things, anti-foreigner rhetoric, populism, xenophobia, creeps into the political mainstream, then people feel emboldened. They maybe always held those views, but have kept them back because of political correctness, feel emboldened to speak out. And so we're seeing it surfacing more.
Mm.
So, but when you've got a politician in the United States, a presidential candidate, labeling all Mexicans as rapists and criminals, It's hardly surprising that ordinary people think it's okay to do the same.
I'm not thinking that that was the outcome they wanted, but certainly the debate about around Brexit, there was a lot of finger pointing at foreigners taking our jobs and that they shouldn't be here. Now, that you can, if you're an eloquent politician, you can say that in a way that is nuanced, but actually some people were saying it in rather brutal terms, and it's not surprising that that emboldened some people who felt that they were backed by the political class, to get rid of people and to attack people.
Well, it is at times a difficulty when you've got people, a large number of ordinary people, decent people, who feel that the society, the economy has left them behind, and you have that sort of anti-establishment vote. And when you've got another group of politicians who's basically blaming foreigners or immigrants for it, when it's much more complicated and much more complex than that, it's hardly surprising. I think it's incumbent upon a political establishment to stop excusing their failures to build more houses and build more schools and build more hospitals on the fact that a bunch of Poles have turned up to take jobs that nobody else wants.
Well, we're almost at the end of today's show, and it's just about time for tea here in London. Though sadly, I doubt any of us will be lucky enough to make the list for President Obama's final state dinner tomorrow. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, has been busy sampling appetizers, apparently, prepared by the chef Mario Batali. I saw a nice picture of him turning up in orange Crocs to talk to her, so I'm not sure about his dress sense. Anyway, but the meal will be served at the White House in an official ceremony honouring Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. What Italian delicacies should we be looking forward to? Are there any dishes that ought to be avoided during such diplomatic events? I'm going to start with you, William, because I imagine you've hosted quite a few diplomatic events in your role as ambassador.
I've also been at number of state dinners. Usually the food is very good. Her Majesty serves a very traditional fare, and likes her Pouligny Montrachet. But in this one, I mean, here you have got an Italian chef who's being asked to do the state dinner for the President of Italy. What a challenge for him. I suppose the one thing he can't serve is the one Italian dish that was invented in the United States, and that was pizza. So I'm sure he want to do Italian with an American twist.
There's something about your name that gives me a hint you might have a view on this subject as well. What was your take on serving up a fine Italian state banquet?
Honestly, what really surprised me about this story was, as I was reading back and I read all the detail of the previous dinners and the state dinners they've had and who they're, I noticed that they do tend to seem to find an individual from the sort of ethnic background of the country that's visiting. And it seems a bit strange to me that you would invite someone over to your country, to your house for a big state dinner, and then serve them their own food by your interpretation. Wouldn't it make more sense to serve them some sort of American fare? And it's sort of funny to me, because sort of the Chinese state dinners, they had a Chinese chef, the Japanese when they had a Japanese chef. It just seems like an odd combination to me. I'm sure Mario Batali will serve some incredible food. I went to one of his restaurants, I think, in the States at one point for a very small meal because it was very expensive. But it was very tasty. So I'm sure that they will have a very good meal, and Matteo Renzi will go back happy and with a smile on his face.
Well, apparently he does like 17 different starters. He's saying there's no kind of, you can't place an order. It's like one thing coming your way. When you've gone to a proper state dinner, as you say, hosted by the Queen, for example, is the food any good? Or I always worry that it's going to be like rather chilly by the time it gets to you.
No, they're pretty good. They're well versed in this. I think it comes out of the kitchen.
They've done this dance before.
They've done it before.
Is there diplomacy on the plate, as it were?
When I've been there, it's always been British in some form or other, Welsh lamb or Scottish, and there's an attempt to create a menu that's very British. The wines recently are British. They haven't been in the past, but there's a very amusing story of a state banquet in the Emirates. I went to a state banquet for the Queen, and there they're very precise. As soon as the head table gets served first, and in a banquet of 2,000 people, as soon as they've finished, they go. Well, I was at the very end, very young diplomat, and my starter hadn't even arrived when the banquet was finished.
And just quickly, just tell me, you've worked in many Muslim countries where you've invited people around for hospitality of the British government, where I presume you can't be serving up the old whiskey. Maybe you can be, but just tell me, how does diplomacy work when you're in Iraq, cutting back to Iraq quickly, when you hosted people?
If you didn't serve whiskey, nobody would come, I can tell you.
Well, there you have it. That's British diplomacy on a plate and in a glass, it turns out, as well. Well, William Patey and Raphael Pantucci, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Pacheco and also by Judith Serra. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow night. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much and goodbye.